Okay, one more item before the break, and that is number 10, Wildlife Rehabilitation Regulations. This is a briefing and a public hearing. And a number of staffers here to present.
You want me to set it up for you?
Yeah, that'd be great. Is it on there, or do you need a little?
What are we, 10?
Exclamation mark, so it should be right at the top.
We renamed them all.
Oh.
Oops. It's three sheets, not PowerPoint. We're 10.
That's it.
There you go.
All right.
Welcome, Tricia.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the Commission, and good afternoon to Deputy Director Storr and Director Anderson. Well, thank you for having me here. And I am Patricia Thompson. I've been with the agency for 26 years in various roles and capacities. And right now I am the Wildlife Rehabilitation, Falconry, Scientific Collections, Education Collection Permit Coordinator of all those things. So I have, you know, even in this position, I have several roles. So what I would like to talk to you about today is, again, yes, brief you on wildlife rehabilitation and our wildlife rehabilitation program, and then propose some changes and updates to the wildlife rehabilitation rule, of which we now have one, and we are proposing several, as much as 15, for reasons that hopefully you'll see. All right, so just an outline of what we're going to talk about today to get you acquainted with this presentation is I'll give a overview of Washington wildlife rehabilitation, hopefully do that quickly because I could talk about it forever, but I'll try and just go through the rules that pertain to it now and the permits and permitting process that the rehabilitators go through, and then our role in wildlife rehabilitation. And then we'll talk about my favorite, the purpose and importance of wildlife rehabilitation. And hopefully you'll be able to see what role wildlife rehabilitators play in assisting the public in the state of Washington. The services that they provide, and then we like them so much that we give them money. And I'll explain that to you when we get to the little grant portion, and that won't be too long. We'll review the current WAC, like I say, which is one, Wildlife Rehabilitation Permits, and then go through why we need to clarify these rules and why we need to expand this rule, because there are some very critical areas that were not represented in this WAC. So, and then, of course, we'll try and go over some of what those proposed wildlife rehabilitation rules are. All right, what I want to emphasize is wildlife rehabilitation is a profession. It's a medical profession that requires lots of training and lots of education and basically an apprenticeship. It's not a hobby. It's not a pastime, which before it was regulated, it kind of was. And that was not a good thing for the people who brought the wildlife in, and certainly not a good thing for the individual animals, the wildlife that was brought in. The public has an expectation of getting this service. They bring thousands of individual animals into our wildlife rehabilitators each year. And by creating these wildlife rehabilitation rules, we're able to facilitate our interaction with the rehabilitators and facilitate the interaction of the public with the rehabilitators, hopefully in a positive way, and then also for a healthy, positive way for the animals as well. So these are the regulations that govern, if you will, the wildlife rehabilitation program in our state. The first one, the WAC 232-12-275, is really what we work under now to permit the wildlife rehabilitators. And the next two statutes are what drive, so it was the first one, 469, that kind of started this whole thing about looking into the wildlife rehabilitation regs, because the legislature said, well, we really need to look into wildlife rehabilitators because they're not quite as regulated as we would like them to be. So I jump in there and, you know, and I start looking into the wildlife rehabilitators and seeing some of the needs. And the next statute is the grant program, which is funded by personalized license plates. So it's basically voluntary. If people want to buy the license plates, they do. And then $2 of those purchases go to the wildlife rehabilitation grant. And then the last statute, rehabilitation of wildlife, the rules, that's the oiled wildlife, right? Andy, my colleague, is the oiled wildlife person. That's the oiled wildlife statute. So that's a separate issue than just the general wildlife rules. A little bit of history on the rules. In going back through the WACs, through the wildlife rehabilitation permits, the earliest ones that I could really find, not having, you know, all the historical records of these, was in 1998 is when the wildlife rehab permits, the 275, was first filed. And what's interesting about that is that in 1989 is when the first edition of the minimum standards for wildlife rehabilitation was printed and issued by the National Wildlife Rehab Association and the International Wildlife Rehabilitation Council. And more locally, what's interesting, and that's when PAWS Wildlife kind of came into being as well. So the late 80s seemed to be the 100th monkey of the wildlife rehabilitation in Washington, because everything kind of came together then. And in 1990 was when the authority adopted oiled wildlife care rules came into being. The Title 90 is the water rights environment RCW, so that's what that falls under. And then 1996, the wildlife rehab WAC underwent an updating like I'm proposing here, and it too went out to the stakeholders, so the stakeholders, the rehabbers, could read the draft rules and comment. And that's exactly what they did here. They were sent out to all the stakeholders, all the wildlife rehabilitators, and they were able to comment. So as you can see, that's kind of a long time ago. And in a medical profession, things change quickly. And we need to kind of step up our regulation of this medical profession. 2004, the oiled wildlife facility requirements were added. Oiled wildlife facilities are very, very specific for oiled wildlife rehab, much more specific than general wildlife rehabilitation facilities. They need a certain amount of airflow, a certain amount of ventilation, just very specific. So this took effect in 2004. And it was 2007 that those two statutes, the 469, the renewal of wildlife rehabilitation licenses, we were instructed to, number one, figure out how to evaluate wildlife rehabilitators. And there was nowhere in the current statute where it said, okay, wildlife rehab licenses expire in 3 years or whatever. So that was actually the impetus, again, behind all this. And then, of course, the next one in 2007 was the grant. And then in 2009, I was put into the wildlife rehab program position to basically implement the grant RCW and the renewal of wildlife rehabilitation licenses RCW. So that's where this is coming from. That's the very beginning of this. Okay, so the permits. Permits ensures the highest quality of professionalism and care, resulting in the release of truly healthy wild animals. Of course, this is what the wildlife rehabilitators want to do, and that's release truly healthy wild animals. The definition of a truly healthy wild animal coming from a wildlife rehabilitator is healthy physically and healthy psychologically. There's a lot more that goes into wildlife rehabilitation than just making them better, you know, just healing their little owies and, you know, making them not sick anymore. So there's a lot that goes into that. So why do we need these permits? Well, you can't have wildlife if you don't have a permit. So it's illegal to possess and treat wildlife without one of these permits. With permits, we can verify the qualifications of the wildlife rehabilitators. It gives us a chance to ask how much experience have you had, where has your education been, who have you trained with, and their qualifications. We can verify the proper, if they have proper facilities for the treatment of the animals and if they can handle these animals well enough. Somebody that has an in-home wildlife rehab facility cannot rehabilitate bears. You know, they can't rehabilitate bear, they can't rehabilitate cougar. So we have to look at their facility to see if their facilities are adequate. What this does is it ensures the safety of the public as well as the well-being of wildlife. There are three stages of treatment for wildlife rehabilitation. There's the intake critical control where they're very confined. There's the intermediate care where they are moved up to a slightly larger cage where they can start to move around. And then there's the end care where they're put outside into a facility, into a large enough cage where they can actually exercise. In the case of predators, they can catch their prey and practice and all that, you know, acclimatized to the weather and the things that they weren't able to do inside. Permits ensures the safety and health of the wildlife rehabilitators. One of those things that we really require is their knowledge of zoonotic diseases. I wrote many questions on zoonotic diseases into the general wildlife exam. And then also we can go do random checks to find out if their children are hugging the deer. So we are allowed to show up at reasonable hours to do checks, and that's what the conditions of the permit allows us to do. So our wildlife rehabilitators, we have 67 licensed wildlife rehabilitators and 52 facilities. They're scattered around the state, but we're missing them critically in King County and Pierce County, and also in the middle of the state. So we have them scattered, but we need more. The initial care veterinarians are those that have agreed to be on our website, and their phone number is posted on the website so they can be called and take those. Any veterinarian in the state can receive and admit wildlife, but they have to give it to a wildlife rehabilitator in about 48 hours. Our current permitting process. They have to go through a very rigorous application process and examination process. It's not something we just let them do. The application is 7 pages long, and the facility inspection is 6 pages long, and they have to basically pass go through all the hoops that they need to leap through to be a wildlife rehabilitator. And what do we do? The WDFW role in wildlife rehabilitation. Well, first of all, we're regulatory. And what I really want to say here is we know, even, you know, I, as the wildlife rehabilitation coordinator, I know that the department manages on the population level. We do not manage on the individual level. However, the public likes to manage on the individual level. So when they find an injured animal, they really want a place to take that animal. So the role that wildlife rehabilitators really play is for the public as well as releasing healthy wildlife. So ours is regulatory in that we evaluate the qualifications of the rehabbers and do all those things that I said that we need to do during permitting. Also, I feel like it's incumbent upon me to provide the wildlife rehabilitators with the service of digging up current information, distributing current information. This lovely little piece of wildlife there is a tick that is carrying an emerging zoonotic disease, and I like my rehabbers to know about that. We update the standards, and I distribute those, maintain the website. It's nice website, if you'd like to go visit that. And so I really like to be able to answer the questions completely for the wildlife rehabilitators. Oiled Wildlife is a specialized program within that. The Habitat Program Oil Spill Team is responsible for directing the oiled wildlife response. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the organization that delegated the authority to WDFW to do that. So this is kind of in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have two mobile units that are owned by our contractors, and we have two facilities licensed to care for oiled wildlife. It's quite a specialty. Okay, interesting picture break. You can see that these two animals are, one's a threatened species and one is an endangered species. So one of the things that rehabbers do are rescue our listed species. The Fruginous hawk was cared for in Benton City, and the western pond turtle, which is suffering, practically the whole population is suffering from shell rot, and Paws Wildlife Center has agreed to care for our western pond turtles that are suffering from this. So again, the primary service is wild release. An equally important service is public assistance and education. The wildlife rehabilitators actually educate the public that wildlife should be managed on a population level. The public has a great need to take these wildlife into a good care facility. Paws Wildlife admitted 3,000 animals last year. Sarvey admitted 2,000 animals, give or take, usually give. And West Sound Wildlife Shelter on Bainbridge Island admitted over 1,000 animals. So right there, that's 6,000 animals that they admitted into their facilities, and that's only three facilities. So clearly, this is something that that wildlife rehabilitators can do, but the department could never provide that service on that scale because it's a very large scale. And, of course, the other services, disease monitoring and peer-reviewed journals and self-regulation. The really scary picture there, that's PAWS Wildlife's West Nile virus protocol. That's how dangerous it gets sometimes. Grants, just really quickly, again, we give them money. It's biennial. There are two examples there. The deer enclosures were $14,700, and that nice raptor flight cage was $6,500, and that was grants received from us. And this biennium, we're giving approximately $107,000 divided between 11 facilities. And those facilities really have to go through a rigorous application process. It's not just given.
Can you give us that number again?
Which one? The amount of money that we're giving in total this biennium, it's approximately $107,000 gained from the personalized license plate sales divided between 11 facilities. Okay? And the approved use of grant funding is just about everything but nuisance species and exotic species. So they have to prove that the money is not going for those urban nuisance species and the invasive species. Okay, so our current wildlife rehabilitation permits, again, it was last updated in 1996. Everything is in one rule. And in the years that I have been in the wildlife rehabilitation program, many, many, many questions came up from the wildlife rehabilitators that were very difficult to answer and were not encompassed in this one rule. The guidelines are very general, and the rehabbers don't know what to do with it. And, you know, I'm sometimes guiding them along on how to comply with our rules with wildlife rehabilitation. See the moose? It's not stuffed. That's what happens when somebody doesn't have a really good definition of habituation and imprinting, and we put a very strong definition of habituation and imprinting in the new rules. And that's only one thing that we put in there. All right, the need to strengthen and clarify these rules. Of course, again, that was mandated by that statute to start getting a handle on the wildlife rehabilitators. Start being able to visit them more often, permit in a more structured way, and tighten up on the reg. So there it is, right there. Supply the detailed guidelines to them so they are more comfortable with what they're doing and they can come into compliance and not basically innocently break the rules, where I can answer the questions for them that come up. The tighter rules make it easier for us to be able to enforce the standards, because we can kind of point to it and say, oops, this is where you messed up, and they will be able to kind of clean up their act. They'll be able to come back into compliance. And the wildlife rehabilitators, frankly, you know, this might have been one of the big things that got this started too, were confused. They were confused. I mean, they call me up, say, I'm confused. So they will make them much more comfortable with these rules. We changed several of the definitions. Again, imprinting and habituation was one of them. Primary permittee was another one of them. We tightened up the requirements where they were actually added into separate WACs, into separate rules, so you can look them up and say, how do I release these animals? They can look it up and they can find exactly where it says, how do they release this animal? The permit duration was that when our permit's going to expire. That was written in there as well. Reinstatement, can out-of-state rehabilitators rehabilitate Washington wildlife is another one that came up. The one I skipped, reportable diseases. Well, diseases come and go. You know, there's always the disease of the year. But in consultation, quite detailed consultation with our veterinarian, Dr. Kristen Mansfield, we were able to come up with a list of diseases that are reportable zoonotic and epizootic diseases, meaning they can contaminate just about everything, and put that in there, and those have to be reported to Dr. Mansfield within 24 hours. And that's what I meant by rehabilitators tracking disease. It's an important service of theirs. Non-releasable wildlife was an issue. Can I keep this? You know, it's friendly. Can I keep it? Well, yes and no. You know, so we have built those regulations into the proposed WACs as well. And that goes for the commercial and education restrictions. More additions and clarifications. We are actually issuing now formal endorsements for raptors, and it is proposed in the WACs for large carnivores. Oiled wildlife also gets a special endorsement. So those rules were put into these proposed WACs so we could actually say, this is what you have to do to rehab a bear. This is what you have to, these are your qualifications. Sub-permittees were an issue, and they were one of the issues that I believe the legislators were thinking of when they enacted that statute about cleaning up the rehabbers. Sub-permittees were kind of everywhere. And rehabbers would say to their volunteers, one of their volunteers, can you take these home and work? Well, we didn't know where our wildlife was going. So we wrote in there some very specific sub-permittee requirements and qualifications. Falconers, in the 2010 Falconry WAC, was included a rule that falconers would help condition raptors for wildlife rehabilitators. So in this update of our WACs, we had to match what the falconry WAC said, and we also had to come into compliance with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. When I was writing that into the rehab WAC, I discussed it quite thoroughly with Fish and Wildlife Service in Portland, saying, okay, you permit falconers to help wildlife rehabilitators with conditioning raptors. So that's a partnership that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service allows. And I said, how are you guys doing that? We'll write that in there so we're in compliance with your regs as well. And this is something that the rehabbers have been very happy with. It takes quite a bit of burden off of them in order to be able to move those raptors out and condition them off-site with somebody, as in a falconer, who knows exactly how to fly and condition a raptor. Permit revocation helps us basically not pull permits. We're not going in there and saying, we're going to take your permit away because you're doing this wrong. The intent is more to say, okay, you're not in compliance with this rule, and we will give you 30 days to come back into compliance. If not, guess what? We have a revocation rule. So it's not that we're going to come in and yank permits, although I have had to do that twice. It's more to protect us, protect the rehabber, protect the public, because the public is really relying on these wildlife rehabilitators to rehab these animals in a safe and humane manner. Future initiatives, the bullets with the asterisks, are written into the proposed WACs, the proposed wildlife rehabilitation WACs, the rules that we're presenting today. The other ones, the non-native and nuisance species guidelines, is an issue that we've been talking about with the rehabbers for a long time. Bat guidelines for safety of the rehabbers, training, and the automated database is for me. I would love that automated database, and we will get to that. But anyway, those ones without the asterisks, those, I'm not going to be coming back to you and saying we want these into new rules. Those are things that can be done outside the WACs, and we'll just be providing those things for our wildlife rehabilitators. So thank you. Hopefully, in the time that I had, I was able to explain wildlife rehabilitation, maybe what we're getting at these proposed WACs. That will help the rehabilitators. It will help me serve the rehabilitators. But really, first and foremost, besides providing a healthy, humane environment for these literally thousands of animals that the public brings in and depends upon these rehabbers to know what they're doing. So if there's any questions, I'd be glad to.
Looks like we have a few. Commissioner Caney first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple clarifications. I think I heard you say it, but I didn't catch it. Well, first, when you talk wildlife, that means everything from an inch and a half sparrow that just fell, baby sparrow that just fell out of its nest, I assume.
Yes, it does.
And how long does someone who finds that have to get it to a rehabilitator? Did you say 48 hours? I mean, someone finds it and you make a call to the rehabilitator and they're not home.
Yeah.
So you start feeding it worms.
Yeah.
I don't. My wife does. And then she gets a hold of Linda, and Linda says, oh, meet me in Tenasca, and she takes whatever she found up there. But how long do you have? I mean, there's this time period that goes on.
So are you asking if you find wildlife and you are in good faith trying to get it to a rehabilitator, how long can you keep that animal and then get it to the rehabilitator?
Yeah.
You, of course, try and get it to the wildlife rehabilitator as quickly as possible because they're the ones that know how to take care of it. But if in good faith you are trying to get it there, if it takes a day or so, that's okay. So is that what you were asking, Commissioner? Yeah, that's okay. And is it Lisa that you work with?
I think it's Linda. I can't remember her last name, but she's like in the theater, and so she's off doing acting, and then you call her, and she's not there, and there's always stuff. And people call me because they think I guess I would know what to do with a hawk with a broken wing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad this is a great talk, and I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you for listening.
Just
get in there quick.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good talk.
No, thanks.
I learned quite a bit from
good.
You. You're talking about thousands of animals in these, what was there, 62 or 67 of these people around that do this.
Yes.
Who pays for this business? The grants from the department certainly wouldn't support a business like that, so
no.
Who pays for it?
Wildlife rehabilitators run their businesses, number one, with their own cash. It's very expensive. And number two, with some very heavy-duty fundraising. It's all donation only. They may not charge to rehabilitate wildlife. It's all donations.
What if somebody brings in, you mentioned nuisance species or something like a starling or a non-native species that maybe we're trying to reduce the population and so forth.
Yeah.
What happens to those critters?
It is up to the wildlife rehabilitation facility and the wildlife rehabilitator to choose the species that they rehabilitate, and they may rehabilitate exotic species and nuisance species. They may not use grant money to rehabilitate those species, but part of that is if when the public brings in a starling, a house sparrow, a eastern gray squirrel, they want those animals rehabilitated. And so if the rehabber chooses to take those animals, they are allowed to do it.
And then they're released?
They are released.
Thank you.
And to add to that, let me see if I can get back here. See where it says non-native and nuisance species guidelines? That's what I'm getting at. There are some rehabilitators that feel, as we do, that those nuisance invasive species should not be rehabilitated and released. So that is one of the discussions we very seriously will be having because, you know, of course there are some that want to rehab them.
Just one other comment. There was a woman this morning that talked about a controversy. A rehabilitator that would be located very close to a state border, and
yes.
Somebody from another state would be helping them out, and so forth. It seemed to me like that was totally immaterial. It's working on the critter, isn't it? That's an important thing, not where they're from, not where the rehabilitator is from.
That's the way we feel, and we've had a relationship with Blue Mountain Wildlife for a very long time. And they do have a facility also in Benton City. Is that the one you're referring to?
I don't think she was very specific on that.
Okay.
But I think she was intimating to us that there was people from other states that were working with our rehabilitators, and somehow that wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't quite follow it.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't seem to me like it was, well, I won't go any farther than that.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Commissioner Smith?
I think that the issue this morning on that question that Commissioner Perry raised was as being a recipient of a grant. At least that's where I was kind of reading in between the lines. And could the recipient of the grant be a non-Washington resident?
Mm-hmm.
But if the one you're saying is the one, then they have a facility in Washington as well. But I think that was the issue.
Yes, I you're right. That the grant was part of the issue, and we have had a lot of discussions on that because it's a valid point. It's a valid question for somebody to ask. And because of that, I have gone through the AG to check and make sure if, in fact, it is okay for this facility to receive our grant money. And Blue Mountain does have a Washington permit because they do so much Washington wildlife, and Blue Mountain does have a Washington facility in Benton City. So, okay.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you. I was just going to add real quick to your question about who pays for it. You know, in case of an oil spill, you have the spiller.
Yeah. Just so we get you on the record.
In the case of your question about a oil spill and who pays for it in that situation, it's actually the spiller's responsibility to pay for the rehabilitation. So it's not, those events aren't actually paid for by the rehabber. It would be the spiller's responsibility.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. Thanks.
He knows all wildlife.
Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Chair. So going back to Marsha Dallin's comments this morning, she was talking about out-of-state residents, and so I'm looking at page 13 of what you gave us, 8 out-of-state wildlife rehabilitators, and it talks about if you're moving to Washington for the purpose of residency and wish to do that, you have to follow the permits. But it doesn't actually say that we can. When I read it, it doesn't say one way or the other about issuing a permit to a non-resident. So, right. Is there clarity around that? Can we issue a permit to a non-Washington resident?
We would prefer not to issue a permit to a non-resident, but the reason why that permit was issued is because they do have a facility in Washington and take a lot of our Washington wildlife. And, you know, there are border issues, too. Moving wildlife back and forth between the Idaho-Washington border and the Oregon-Washington border, where our veterinarian says no to moving mammals around. However, we've come to an agreement with the rehabilitators and the Department of Agriculture in Oregon that says we can move birds back and forth across the border. And it's an interesting question for oiled wildlife about out-of-state permits, because for what birds move around, you know, oil spills are interstate. And
one of the things that we thought was important about having an out-of-state permit component was that there's a lot of people, like in California, they've got a really advanced network for oil spill response. I'd like to be in a position where we could permit them here, so if they came and used one of our permitted facilities, they could lead an effort. So from my perspective, that was something that I was looking at maintaining.
And then my second question, going back to what a concern she raised, was injured raptors that get turned in, working with the falconer to rehabilitate them, but then keeping them for falconry purposes. And so I'm looking at page 21, section 6. It says a primary permittee can transfer a raptor directly to a falconer for falconry purposes so long as the falconer can lawfully possess the species. So.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
That's an interesting one, because the public's turning it in thinking it's going to be rehabilitated and released, and instead it's being turned into a working animal.
Right, and really where this one came from, and that is true, if a raptor comes into a rehabilitation facility and it can be free-flown for falconry purposes, it can be transferred to a falconer for falconry purposes. However,
is that currently true, or is that proposed?
Well, we do that. It's proposed in more detail in this.
It's not explicitly authorized now, it's just a practice?
Yeah, and basically where that came from is we have wild take peregrine permits, and a lot of times the chicks will pre-fledge or they'll hit the water, and so they have to go right to the rehabilitator, and a member of the public or even one of our officers gets called and they take it to a rehabilitator. Well, the chick is really perfectly healthy, just needs a few days of recovery, and those fledglings now, because they can take fledged peregrines, can go to a falconer to be flown for falconry purposes.
And I guess just I heard her concern, and I guess I would sort of share that a little bit. I certainly appreciate falconers helping rehabilitate the birds. They've got the expertise to be able to keep them alive and train them and get their wings and muscles strong.
Yeah.
But to transfer a wild animal through the rehabilitation process to a falconer for a working animal,
right,
does seem like somewhat inappropriate,
yeah,
on first blush.
Yeah, and I understand that. I understand that concern, and we can definitely have conversation about that. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does permit that, and we basically follow their regs as well. In fact, they went through this WAC for me. I sent this down to the Portland office, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office in Portland, and had them review this whole entire thing. So,
right, but in our state, we don't always follow other states' approaches to falconry.
That was a Fish and Wildlife Service.
Right,
yeah.
And I'm just saying a lot of other states do. I mean, you know, the discussion we had at the commission when we adopted the falconry rules last time was
right.
We wanted only the species we list. They wanted everything except what was excluded, that type of an approach. So,
right.
Again, just because the feds bless it doesn't mean that that's what the state should do.
That we have to do it, yeah.
I mean, we have to do with the minimum of states, but we can go beyond that, I would think. So, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, any others? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good presentation.
Thank you. All right, we've reached the break, and we are going to defer item number 12. Oh, sorry, no public input on that one. Thank you for catching that. That was a hearing, too, but no one had signed up.
Yeah.
No, item 12 we're going to defer to the next meeting. So we just have one more item on the afternoon agenda, so we can take a 15-minute break. Come back at 4:15, and we'll finish up by 5:00.